in the limelight.
The US is fast moving towards militarization and instead become great as the quixotic president brags. It is poised for its imminent downfall. Stay with us for a two-part article titled Trump Salute, Apotheosis of the Warfare State that appeared on the anti-war site. The writer is David Stockman, a two-term congressman from Michigan, who after leaving the Ronald Reagan White House had a 20-year career on Wall Street and authored three books, including The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America, and Trumpet, A Nation on the Brink of Ruin. Granted, the donut skipped American history class, along with much less that even modestly educated people still recall. But owing to his late life conversion to flag-hugging patriotism, you would think he might have taken time to actually read the Declaration of Independence. Obviously not. We have scoured its 1,334 words, and our recollection was fully vindicated. To wit, there is not a single mention of armed might, military exploits, unfurled flags, marching bands, battle hymns, or occupied airports, etc. Well, except for its reference to King George's brutal use of mercenary armies to quash the colonies, to individual liberty and just self-government. Among Jefferson's long bill of particulars was this. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in most barbarous ages and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. Self-evidently, the Declaration was a jeremiade against tyrannical rule and an evocation of the principles of liberty and the grounding of the state in consent of the governed. That is, the document is libertarian, not statist, through and through, and it was for those principles, not military glory, that 56 courageous signers pledged to each other their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor. Indeed, as the plain language of the Declaration holds, the signers understood liberty to be not a gift of the state or a privilege granted by the king, but rights that were unalienable and pre-existing to any and all forms of government. Jefferson had said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from consent of the governed." Unquote. Accordingly, the Declaration was essentially revolutionary in proclaiming not only pre-existing natural rights, but also a right of the people to abolish the existing state whenever it becomes destructive of liberty and to start anew with a fresh constitution. That's the very opposite of blind worship of the established institutions of government and patriotic subservience to its orders, projects, and pretensions. In the words of Jefferson, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form, as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness, unquote. Not surprisingly, therefore, the most stirring portions of the document focus on the righteousness of the signer's opposition to the king's tyrannical rule. The resulting threat of absolute despotism veritably conferred on them a duty to overthrow such government and to thereby reclaim those unalienable rights of the people which were endowed by their creator. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. So we have a new flash for the Donald. The 4th of July is not Memorial Day. It is not an occasion for tribute to those fallen in America's wars, just or otherwise, nor for brandishing the military capacities and lethal weaponry that may give rise to additional such sacrifices in the future. To the contrary, it is a celebration of the birth of liberty. It's a time to minimize the state and remind that it is the servant of a free people and that its remit is conditioned upon a scrupulous regard for the rights, prosperity, and happiness. After all, even the traditional fireworks displays on the 4th were never understood to be a celebration of battles won or enemies defeated. It was a spontaneous expression of rejoicing by the citizenry that they and their rights are preeminent in America because 243 years ago its founding fathers had the courage to revolt against an unjust ruler. That's why the Donald's military extravaganza on the Mall was so tone-deaf offensive and profoundly anti-conservative in the traditional small government, pro-liberty and free market sense of the term. But it goes far beyond tonalities and misplaced symbolism. As Randolph Bourne famously proclaimed amidst the insane carnage of the First World War, "War is the health of the state. Today, we have a permanent $1 trillion per year war for state, counting debt service and $200 billion for veterans, that would have terrified even Bourne. That's because it represents a raw and wholly unnecessary aggrandizement of the state and far-flung machinery of empire, an illicit undertaking that has no basis in the security and liberty of the homeland or in the concept of a peaceful republic that led the signers of the declaration to expose themselves to the terminal justice of the king's hangman. Stated differently, the American war for state is now so massive and embedded in the wrap and woof of national governance that it writes its own ticket, or, in the metaphor of hot 4th of July afternoons, has become a self-licking ice cream cone. It simply declares untrue things, which are then used to justify its missions, budgets, and monumental lethal capacities for military action." In recent times, these untrue things include the claim that Russia annexed Crimea against the will of its people, that China is lacing Huawei cell phones and network gear with secret spy equipment, that we must risk war with many nations because the neocons have overruled its right to have an independent foreign policy. That North Korea must give up its entire nuclear capacity before the Korean Peninsula can be demilitarized, even though it remains surrounded by a massive armada of American warships, planes, and land forces in Japan and the Pacific waters. It also falsely claimed that Libya's Muammar Gaddafi had to be bombed because he was fixing to massacre his own people, that Saddam had to be taken out because he was harboring weapons of mass destruction and allied operatives, and that the benighted Taliban rulers of Afghanistan needed to be overthrown and the Afghan graveyard of empires occupied indefinitely because they once harbored a few hundred al-Qaeda fighters who have long since vamoosed or have been liquidated along with their leader Osama bin Laden. Further back in time, that warfare state emitted the big lie that the pretty quarrel between Saddam and the Emir of Kuwait in 1990 required the mobilization of 500,000 American troops to rescue the bank accounts of the latter. That the disappearance of the Soviet Union from the pages of history in 1991 did not obviate the need for NATO and a massive U.S. conventional military force, the primary purpose for which had been to contain the Red Army and its 50,000 largely inoperative or unfueled tanks and related land forces, and that Washington had a dog in 1980s fracas between Iran and Iraq that required a policy of tilting toward the latter and assisting Saddam's genocidal use of chemical weapons on essentially Iranian soldiers. Reaching even deeper into history, it was also the machinery of the warfare state and its auxiliaries, think tanks, and military-industrial complex lobbies that falsely held that Vietnam was a domino, albeit hidden in the jungles of Southeast Asia, that dare not be allowed to fall to the international communist rulers of the day, rulers who were otherwise engaged in vicious conflict among themselves and in genocidal depredation upon their own people, and that the mere surveyor's line at the 38th parallel of the Korean Peninsula, as Secretary Dan Ashen correctly put it in a moment of post-Second World War lucidity, required a savage war on the North in order to save Western civilization. And on, it has gone for more than 70 years, and in fact from the time that Teddy Roosevelt pulled his Rough Rider stunt on San Juan Hill and then, upon blooding his way into the Oval Office, commenced yapping about carrying a big stick and building a huge blue water navy that was absolutely unnecessary for the defense of the American public, given that the vast Atlantic and Pacific moats and a shoreline defense were more than enough to keep any potential old-world aggressors at bay. Indeed, a few short years later, the carnage along the western front of Europe proved the point. There was zero reason for America's entry into the Great War in April 1917 because by then the belligerents had all already bankrupted themselves and bled their economies and populations to the point of collapse or revolt. American troops ended up in the decimated hellholes of northern France only because of President Woodrow Wilson's vainglorious and messianic desire to have an important seat at the eventual post-war peace table. But Wilson blew even that and acquiesced to a vindicative peace of victors as embodied in the destructive Treaty of Versailles. The latter soon paved the way for the revanchist nightmare of Nazi Germany and consolidation of power by the tiny band of communist fanatics in Russia who had seized power in Petrograd in November 1917 only owing to Wilson's intervention in a war that was otherwise over. From that horrible mistake, of course, that amounts to a century of war followed inexorably thereupon. So there is no other way to slice it. Contrary to the Donut's seventh great history lesson, America did not have a glorious military history after the Revolutionary War based on the fact that men died on battlefield in defense of liberty and democracy. They didn't. When it came to defense of the latter, God or Mother Nature, as the case may be, took care of that long ago when they placed America safely between the great Atlantic and Pacific Ocean moats. Moreover, once America industrialized because it had capitalism, small government and borders open to massive inflow of liberty-seeking economic and political refugees from the old world, 40 million between 1850 and 1923, there was never any risk of invasion. There was never any need for a vast military establishment, let alone today's $1 trillion war for a state. The latter has also been an instrument of empire, not a guardian and savior of domestic liberty, prosperity, and happiness itself. And that's exactly why the two Bradley fighting vehicles and two 60-ton Abrams tanks displayed near the memorial were so profoundly inappropriate. There never has been and never will be a time in the life of this planet that a foreign power could deliver a massive expeditionary force to the American shores that would require a defensive counterattack by these vehicles of war. Abrams tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles are strictly instruments for invading and occupying foreign lands. Dear listeners, that was the first part of former U.S. Congressman David Stocksman article, Trump's Salute, Apotheosis of the Warfare State. Tune in tomorrow for the second and concluding part.